starting to hit the deep bowels of Detroit, and we talked with an insurance adjuster here in the local area, and what they're saying is they're getting 30 to 40 fires a night. I mean, you're seeing houses like this that are abandoned. Go over here, this one looks like it's freshly burned out. Is a city within the city of Detroit, but they've recently lost their police and their fire funding capabilities, and now they're being taken over by the bigger city of Detroit.
In cities like Detroit, Cleveland, Buffalo, Mogadishu, Nairobi, Murmansk, you're seeing this sort of phenomena. And it's also clear climate change-driven disasters lurk around the corners for Sunbelt cities like Atlanta and Phoenix, where water supplies are down to, I think in Atlanta, it's 90 days. The lake they're drawing water from is disappearing. In Detroit, the population declines by about 1,000 people every month. And like any other refugee city, it is in the anomalous position of not having enough city services and too many. It has more neighborhoods, roads, and public services than it needs, and the ones that continue to be occupied don't have enough services.
There were 50 schools here in the Detroit area that were slated to be closed down, shut down, and now that's about 23 or 25 schools. So as you can see here in Detroit, schools are closing down. They're becoming like ghost towns.
This is a recipe for creating unsustainable cities. This is New Orleans. Absolutely. This is Buffalo. This is Detroit. This is Cleveland. This is the recipe for refugee cities. Because at the end of the day, cities have to work for all their residents, not just some of them. Nations are so large they can get along for a very long time with substantial territories that suffer terribly from poverty, suicide, despair. But cities have much smaller tolerances, simply because everyone lives so much closer to each other. Thus, the rot spreads much faster. The good news is, if you can get it right, the productive and successful also spread much faster. Refugee cities all share the same basic characteristics. Entire neighborhoods become vandalized shells. Public infrastructure is battered, broken, and unreliable. This means schools, libraries, train stations, parks, public places are not places you would want to frequent unless you had no other choice. In refugee cities, both petty and violent crime become a way of life.
Hey, we're in downtown Detroit, and you can see houses like this everywhere. I mean, we're talking hundreds, thousands of houses that are blown out, beat up, burnt down, squatters living in them. I mean, this is just like, it's worse than Baghdad here. It looks definitely like a third world country.
American cities in decay. Refugees, not from New Orleans after Katrina. This is a different kind of hurricane, a trifecta of climate change, high oil prices, and the real estate bubble. It leaves an abandoned hole in places like Detroit, Philadelphia, Phoenix, and beyond. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. We'll track the causes and the victims. In our opening cuts, you heard video blogger George Fortitle in his YouTube special called Detroit Ground Zero for Economic Collapse. An amazing drive-by of abandoned and burned-out homes looking like Baghdad in America. It's a five-part series you won't want to miss. Our other voice was Clive Doucette, author and councilman for Canada's capital city, Ottawa. When I recorded his Urban Meltdown speech a year ago, I didn't believe it. Now the evidence is with us. Cities all over North America are under stress as they go into record deficits and collapsing tax collections. Municipal bonds may be the next big default line in our economy. We'll interview Clive Doucette to get that update.
Social conditions, no one will openly visit. The atrocious revisions of our fathers' decisions that cast a shadow like a desert oak.
We are talking millions of foreclosures already, and millions more to go in the next 2 years. In fact, all the mortgage holding agencies, like the government ones, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and the big private banks, they've started a new wave of record foreclosures after a brief Obama rest. You can find that in the Wall Street Journal. Where are all these people ending up? Sure, some people rent, but the latest stats show rentals are actually down. Some new Americans go back to their home country. Other folks move back with their families or share tiny spaces. Too many become homeless, and our social system is in no way prepared for the homeless emergency now developing in almost every city. A friend just told me their neighbors in a relatively upscale neighborhood in Phoenix both lost their jobs. a professional couple. Suddenly, the bailiffs show up and grab both cars, one big SUV, plus the house, a family with five kids, now living in two tents in the desert outside of town with no water or toilets, just like that. Could it happen to you? Are the homeless annoying you? In this program, we'll get a clue. Our guest host, Allert, interviews Harold G. Joe. Harold experienced a fatal homeless tragedy in his community. He decided to try just 3 days and nights on the street. As a documentary filmmaker, Harold took his camera along. The result is the movie Broken Down, and an interview that could move hearts of stone. Let's get back to Clive Doucette, the person who opened my eyes while I was daydreaming in a still-functioning place, a city of refuge, so far in the developing storm. Our guest has studied urban anthropology. He worked in government planning before getting elected himself as a councilman in Canada's capital city, Ottawa. Clive Doucette has worked tirelessly for livable cities and public transit. Clive, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be here with you, Alex.
I'd like to take a second to explain why I called. Well, over a year ago, I heard and recorded you here in Vancouver at the launch of your book, Urban Meltdown, Cities, Climate Change, and Politics as Usual. You surprised me then with the idea that cities don't always grow, and in fact, some may experience a meltdown. You know, at the time, Clive, I have to admit, I was thinking everlasting growth, and I didn't really believe it would get that serious. But now I'm seeing amateur video reports on YouTube of cities and towns floundering and places closing and some with empty blocks or even burned out buildings. Why is this happening?
Well, I think it's because of climate change and resource shortages, basically. If you think about the old adage, it's always been the go west, young man, go west, and make your fortune there. And successive waves of Canadians and Americans have drifted west, and they do to this day, where the skies are bluer and the more resources and the more opportunity. And so when there was a decline in the eastern cities, or the eastern cities stopped growing, there was this safety valve which people just moved to another city. And it's happening to this day. I mean, if you look at the great growing cities of North America, they're all in the west. Boulder, Colorado, Denver, Portland, Vancouver, Seattle. You look in the east and you see cities that are not growing at all. Halifax, Philadelphia, a lot of them are declining. And if they're not declining, they're probably growing in not a very healthy way, like Toronto, where they're getting really surviving on massive immigration of very, very cheap labor. And it's not a healthy growth. As I thought about this, I thought, well, what will happen if the climate change predictions are correct? That the New Orleans and the Philadelphias and the Detroits are not going to become the exceptions. They will become more and more the norm. Eventually, you're going to see a clear line of demarcation between cities that are producing basically refugees, which has never really happened in North America in anyone's memory, and cities that become refuge cities like Vancouver.
Well, you talk about refugee cities, and I think of the example of people dispersed from New Orleans. They went all over the country after Hurricane Katrina. What are some of the other refugee cities that come to mind?
Well, some of them are really surprising. I was invited to very fortunately to a conference in Philadelphia in November, just 2 days after Barack Obama's election, and it was very exciting to going down, and it was an exciting conference too. It was sponsored by the Rockefeller Foundation and the University of Pennsylvania School of Urban Design, and it was to celebrate a conference they had run there with the Rockefeller Foundation 50 years earlier, when they had young Jane Jacobs, prior to her publishing her famous book, A Decline and Fall, Death and Life of Great American Cities, Lewis Mumford, etc. And so it was to celebrate this, mark this first conference. And I arrived excited to be there and to meet the other conferences. But when I got off the plane, the front page of the paper was not Barack Obama, believe it or not. It was the mayor of Philadelphia, and he was announcing their budget, and he was announcing $1 billion in cuts. They were closing 11 local libraries in mostly in the poorest parts of the city. They were closing 68 pools, you know, swimming pools for children. They were closing fire stations, and that was all over. And Barack wasn't there at all. And I looked at this and I thought to myself, my God, what's going on? Well, what's going on was the city was melting down. And Philadelphia is a rich city with a rich history, an optimistic city. It's the home of world champion baseball and football teams. And yet there it was, they weren't unable to run their city. And I think you're seeing that in Detroit, in spades. Detroit is half the population it was 20 years ago. It's less than 1 million. It used to be more than 2 million. You're seeing it in Cleveland, and you're seeing it, you're starting to see it in some Canadian cities.
Well, the national government seems at the same time to be broke and somewhat immobile. Is there a network of conversation at these local levels about how to handle what is really an emergency?
I don't think there is. I think cities are the North American and the Western, especially the North American equivalent of underdeveloped countries. You hear a lot about the travails of African nations and African cities and Asian cities. Nothing ever really gets done about it. It's sort of, well, it's the global south, they're poor, we're rich, you know. And that's the end of the story. And you send a little aid and via an NGO, but nothing structurally ever really changes to alleviate their difficulties. Same thing with cities. Cities, if you're elected to a local city council, whether it's quite a big city like my city, what you quickly find out is, as a councillor, you're kind of like a bit like a short order chef in a really cheap restaurant. You know, you've got you always have 10 things burning on the stove, and you keep running from one to the other just to stop them from burning, and sort of you can get some of them served out to your customers, you know, in the appropriate way. Your time to do the big things that need to be done to change what's making you run from one cheap dish to another never gets done. And I'll give you an example. The mayor of Toronto, David Miller, a couple of years ago started a campaign for the 1 cent now, and 1 cent now of the GST. And his proposition was the federal government should take 1% of the GST and not cut it, but send it directly to cities across the country. And that would have sent to my city $180 million, I think, every year. Well, $180 million is our shortfall. It's the difference between us being able to meet all our needs and being constantly without enough funds. What happened? The federal government cut 1% of the GST, which they figured they didn't need or they could get along without, and we were unable. The mayors and councils of across the country were unable to generate any kind of national campaign to get people to understand how important this was. You know, consider that the federal government, both in the United States and Canada, gets about 50% of your tax dollars. The province gets 48%. The cities, where 60% of your services, most of them essential, you can't live without them, do it on 8 cents on your dollar. That's how little we get. And that 1 cent of the GST meant nothing to the federal government, meant the difference between life and death for cities. I arranged the first march on Parliament Hill ever from the city. We passed a motion to City Council. Half of City Council was Ottawa, which is, you know, a fairly conservative town. We marched on Parliament Hill demanding 1% of the GST in the depths of winter in a snowstorm. And I got a call from David, said, gee, that was great, Clive. You got some attention on the national media. I said, okay, what do we do next? And he said, I've got to run right now. I've got a crisis on Front Street. And that was the last I heard from him. And it's typical of what happens right across the country. You've got city councils who cannot mount the national campaigns necessary to change the environment in which we live.
And even more serious in the United States, where so many the municipalities, their tax base is shrinking, their bonds are not being rated very well. Some of them didn't invest well. You have big deficits, huge deficits. They're having to cut down fire services and police even. I'm wondering, will some cities and towns become unworkable and maybe even be abandoned?
Well, I think that's happening right now with a lot of cities, the Rust Belt in the States. But one of the, it's going on as we speak. The danger, I think, though, is trying to say, well, it's a specific cause. It's happening because Detroit. It's clear why it's happening there. The American auto industry is melting down. Okay, why is it happening in Philadelphia? Why is it happening in Cleveland? Why is it happening in Scranton? Why is it happening in New Orleans? Why is it happening in some Floridian towns?
And Phoenix, and Las Vegas.
In Phoenix. You start to say maybe this isn't an exceptional occurrence. What you're seeing is a common thread, is that cities can no longer afford to be cities. And they can no longer afford to be cities because the economic pillars of which they depended upon have shrunk, and they're different in every place, but the common theme is they've all shrunk and they cannot grow the way they used to grow. They used to roll out asphalt and cement, it was a piece of cake. It was now the cost of rolling out your asphalt and repairing your roads is, because of resource shortages and price increases, is unaffordable for most municipalities. We invested $20 million more in road repair than last year than we did the previous year, and we repaired 20% less. Well, what do you think that means is happening to your city? It means every road is becoming more, not every, but your roads are becoming more pitted and pockmarked and less travelable every year. And that's the kind of crunch every city is in. And what happens when your city doesn't provide adequate services, and it has a knock-on effect? Pretty soon people don't want to live there, and if they don't want to live there, they pick up and go somewhere else. And so you're seeing enormous influxes of people to places like Vancouver and Boulder, Colorado, and Portland, who've become kind of lighthouse cities which people are fleeing to. But the great danger is they're going to be overcome, because the only way to solve this problem is you've got to make all of those cities livable, not just sort of do what we've always done, which is we'll cut your losses. Well, Philadelphia doesn't work anymore, no problem, we'll move west.
Yeah, but Oregon is having big troubles with unemployment, very high unemployment, and here in Vancouver we've had the economy stalling. We've got a glut of unsold new condos and a big hotel project abandoned as a hole in the ground downtown. I'm wondering, have we just hit an unexpected limit to the idea of cities?
I think what's happened is limits to growth has finally hit in. If you remember back in 1974, there was a report signed on by most of the leaders of the Western world, including the Prime Minister of Canada at the time, Trudeau, saying we cannot have a world forever which is based on limitless growth, that sooner or later that growth is going to smack up against limited resources. We can't have infinite growth in a finite world. And I think at the time, back in 1974, people regarded it like E equals MC squared. It was sort of an interesting theory, and it probably was true, but it had no effect on my life. And people kind of, if they read about it, they filed it under that E equals MC squared kind of thought. The trouble is, that was, 40 years ago, and now it's coming true, and it's affecting all of our lives. If we want to continue to be healthy and secure, we have to have healthy, secure cities, because 80% of Canadians and Americans basically live in cities. And the only way you can create secure, safe cities is they have to be based on a sustainable model. In other words, you have to be able to, the taxes you raise have to pay for the services you need. And that's never been the case in any city in North America. The way we fund and make ourselves wealthy is we are constantly borrowing against growth. That's how we develop all our suburbs. We borrow money against anticipated growth. For every dollar of services we put out there, for every dollar of taxes we raise, it costs $1.40 to provide the services. Well, how do we make up that 40-cent gap? We finance it through anticipated growth. Well, you take away that anticipated growth, and what happens? You collapse. Because 40 cents is what? That's close to 30% of your needs every year are shortfalled if you stop growing. So what you have to do is you have to retrofit your cities to actually not grow, but to return enough revenue so you can constantly reinvest in the services you need. Because even if you're not growing, a city requires massive reinvestment every year. Every year you've got to reinvest in your pipes and your sewers and your roads and your transit, and it can be done. The good news is it can be done. You look at the Lewis line in Dublin, electric rail line, it returned a $6.6 million euro surplus in its second year of operation. You can create city services which actually pay for themselves. You cannot, in a non-growth economy, afford to be building high-volume roads that are 100% dependent upon growth revenues.
We are talking with author and politician Clive Doucette. Let's get to the politics-as-usual part of your book. I'm concerned we're moving into uncharted territory here. For example, we only count the homeless every few years, and governments have stopped building public housing. The old models of how to cope could get drowned by a wave of unemployed people whose benefits and credit have run out. Are we at the brink of a major social change here, do you think, for our cities and towns?
I think we are, and what's going to distinguish the cities that are going to do relatively well from those who don't are the ones that are able to make the shift towards a sustainable landscape and a sustainable economy. It's very difficult when you've been doing something for 60 years one way. To make that shift is hard, and the thing is, I know Vancouver and Portland have their difficulties now, just as every other city does. But you compare Vancouver to say Ottawa. We in Vancouver, you have not built a new road in 20 years inside the city, and you have a transit system which is actually diminishing the number of people on your roadways. In my city, we're growing our city by 200 kilometers of new road every year, and we're adding 125 to 50 million dollars worth of new operating costs every year. It's totally unsustainable. You know, I've been to Vancouver and I've been on your transit system. The really neat thing was your transit planner took me on a system, and he said, "Well, we'll just use the system." And we were able to travel around your whole city, and we just moved from one level of transit to another without any real inconvenience. You have no idea how magical that is compared to, say, a city like Ottawa, which has 1,000 buses on the road every day, but all we've got is buses, nothing else but buses, and it basically is a rush hour service. It you cannot move around the city easily just using a bus. If I brought someone here, it would be tempting to take them by a car. You know, that's the kind of, you know, lighthouse hope that initiatives like Vancouver have made that remind the rest of us that we can change.
Well, with their backs to the wall now, for those cities that look like they could be viable, if you could speak to the mayors and the councils, what would you be recommending?
I would recommend to them that they have to think about retrofitting their cities, and that means investing in it in an entirely different way. They've got to build neighborhoods which are self-sustaining. Like, cities are composed of neighborhoods, and you have to start your sustainability from the neighborhood level up. You've got to create neighborhoods where people want to live, work, and play, so that collectively those neighborhoods form like little blocks of Lego. Together they form your city, and your city is strong. If you have neighborhoods that are not self-sustaining, then what happens is they're constantly poaching off another neighborhood or a different part of the city, and you've got an unsustainable cycle going on. That's what you see in most cities. And in the past, we have been able to paper over it by this tremendous growth most cities have felt. I mean, Ottawa, for example, like most Canadian cities, is twice the size it was when I was a child. It's now almost 1 million people, and it was, when I was a child, it was about 400,000 people. But it covers a landscape which is five or six times as big. People take up way more room. So what we've done in the last 50 years is we've created a much bigger city with much bigger demands, but it's much more costly to run, and it's much less sustainable. Our food now, it used to come when I was a boy, we had dairies in the city, we had bakeries in the city. A large part of our food supply came from the Ottawa Valley, which is a broad and fertile valley, now come from Vancouver or from, you know, the southern United States, which is kind of crazy, but that's what we've got. So when you can see the fragility of the city building when instead of having these local strengths and these independent neighborhoods that kind of provide for themselves, you more and more are dependent upon these great big umbilical services. The local grocer in one of the neighborhoods that I represent can tell you when the 18-wheel trailer is leaving from Vancouver for his store in Ottawa. That's really scary, because it means that umbilical cord ever gets severed or changed, and the cost structure gets changed, suddenly life gets much more expensive, much more difficult in this town. So I think politicians have to wake up and realize that all the things that they used to do are not going to work, and start to think about doing things in a way that's going to create these sustainable cities.
We have been talking with Councilman Clive Doucette in Ottawa, Canada. His latest book is Urban Meltdown, Cities, Climate Change, and Politics as Usual. Closing out, Clive, what could the average person do to learn more about this or even help heal this crisis?
I think connect with your local city council and really understand what they're doing and more importantly what they're not doing, and insist on change. The great thing about local politics is it should be at your door. You should be able to talk to your local councilwoman or man and say, you know, we want to do things differently. And if we can lead at the local level, the federal and the state and the provinces will follow. But it's going to take leadership from the local level. I don't think we're going to see it from the upper levels, because it's too much to their advantage. No one wants to give up power, and the federal governments of the nations of North America have had an unequal share of the tax base for centuries, since their formation. So why are they going to give that up? They're only going to give it up if the local councils change the way they spend their money and change their demands. And we as citizens can have that effect if we get engaged at that level.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today. I really appreciate it, Clive.
A real pleasure. And, where there's life, there's always hope.
Okay, and I'm going to point people to your website, too, clivedoucette.com, spelled D-O-U-C-E-T. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. And you can find a free copy, an MP3 download of his speech, Urban Meltdown, on the Cities page of our audio on-demand menu right at ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org.
Sleep in the doorways, I could feel the rats running by me, you know, but I'm so burnt out at the time, and I couldn't go on anymore. It didn't bother me. And when you're sleeping, the rats don't actually come to you and bother you when you're sleeping. They'll run over you or they'll run by you, but they won't go nibbling on you and that.
People fear the homeless. Maybe you repress a worry you could become homeless yourself. At least 1 in 3 people in North America are just 1 or 2 paychecks away from being homeless. For example, if both wage earners lose their jobs, where will the mortgage payment or the rent come from? So many people are just getting by as it is. They have no savings, and a couple of credit cards are already maxed out, big car payments and all those bills. If the money stops, what happens? At least 600,000 Americans lost their jobs last month, and the same the month before that, and every month all through this winter of the economic crash. Jobs have been cutting out in Canada as well, and in the UK. Big companies are laying off, small stores are closing. An economist at the Urban Institute calculates that 700,000 Americans will run out of unemployment benefits by next fall.
Want to get cash and simplify your bills? Ask about a combo loan from Countrywide. It's a refi that you could use to combine your first mortgage, your second mortgage, your car loan, and all your high-rate credit card debt.
We'll arrange to refinance your home and even get you extra cash. Pay off credit card debt. Get a new kitchen. Pay college tuition. Homeowners, call now and close.
The ladder of homelessness begins with renting, maybe, or sharing rent somewhere. Or it could be moving back with the family. As so many people moved around and families broke up in divorce, people started living in their car, if they have one, or maybe a camper. Others go straight to tents, if they can afford one. Or then, there's the streets. Get ready for millions of people to slide down this ladder. If you still have a job, maybe you are sitting at home watching TV as the cops slash up tents and force the homeless to drift to another hiding place. While millions of houses, 1 in 9 in the United States, for example, sit empty, foreclosed, bank-owned. Alternative media makers are starting to catch this wave of new homeless. In Vancouver, the Pivot Legal Society and Simon Fraser University just held a film festival called Real Justice, and that's spelled R-E-E-L. All the films were about the lives of homeless people. Some were filmed by street people themselves. Maybe you've heard of the short film Carts of Darkness by Murray Sipple, S-I-P-L-E. A former snowboard filmmaker, Murray is now trapped in a wheelchair after a serious car accident. He recaptures some of his extreme sports glory by filming homeless people as they race shopping carts down the steep, dizzy roads of North Vancouver. Carts of Darkness is available through the National Film Board of Canada, and you can catch snippets of it on YouTube. It's deeper than kart racing, though. It gets into the dark side of being homeless. On today's EcoShock program, radio producer Allart from CFRO in Vancouver interviews the producer of another Real Justice entry called Broken Down. First Nations filmmaker Harold Joe lives rough for a few days and introduces us to 4 homeless people. Harold comes from the Cowichan Valley on Vancouver Island, but this interview slices right to the core of homelessness everywhere. Before you duck away from that person who seems unkempt and possibly homeless right in front of you, hear this interview.
I'm here with Harold Joe, who is the documentary filmmaker of Broken Down. Harold, what compelled you to do this film?
Broken Down is based around the homeless issue that we have in the Cowichan Valley and all over parts of Canada and the United States. So Broken Down to me is a personal piece that I got involved in. And the reason why I wanted to do the documentary was because it's based around an issue that was evolving in the Cowichan community. I've heard a lot of people talk about homeless people around in the Cowichan Valley that were beginning to, piss people off in a way that they didn't like to see it or didn't want to even look at it, or saying, you know, they're just a bunch of nuisance and drug addicts and alcoholics and causing a major disturbance in our community. And then a tragic thing took place in around February of 2005 with the homeless issue. A fire was set ablaze where these homeless people were staying, and there was 5 of them in this abandoned woodshed. And a couple of youth went in there and literally beat the homeless people with 2x4. And beat all of them, actually, and then got to the last stalls and beat up these 2 native guys that I knew. And once they were finished beating them up, went back and got a jerry can of gasoline and poured it on them and then lit them up, killing one of the friends of mine and seriously almost killing the other gentleman. One passed away and the other one's still alive here, and he's alive in the burn unit here in Vancouver and will not get out. So after that went down, I got irate about it and wanted to do something. So what could I do as a filmmaker? I wanted to do a documentary. So I went about and started to see the homeless people and talk to city council in my community and address the issue, what was going on and why, you know, and the newspapers you hear, well, they're this, they're that. And I just approached them and said, look, something's got to be done, and I'm tired of hearing you guys just basically pass them off like they're garbage. So after that whole incident went down, about months after the funerals and stuff that took place for one of the gentlemen, I just said, I'm going to do a documentary. And I just went out and did it. Didn't have a script. I didn't plan it, pre-plan it, just as I'm going to go out and live and try to live as a homeless person and show these people and get their story, I guess, is what I really wanted, was their story, not mine. But I show you how it is to try to live as a homeless person. And I stay out there for 3 days and three nights and have a struggle trying to survive in it. And it was really an eye-opening experience for me.
And what did you learn from, not only about the homeless people, from doing the experience yourself of living on the streets, what did you also learn about yourself? Both questions.
What did I learn about myself was that, first and foremost, I guess I kind of looked at the whole situation going, well, why am I out here? And what concern does this have to me? Like I said to you just a moment ago, it was personal. So that was why I wanted to do it and why I think that I learned a lot from it on a personal level. And I guess in a spiritual level, too.
What specifically?
Well, what I learned is it's not easy to do what any of these homeless people do, day in and day out. How do you survive? How do you get food and how do you get clothing? And is there any support for that matter? And in our community, there is and there isn't. So, and on a spiritual aspect, the first night, you kind of look at it and you're alone. A lot of them are alone. Some have things or people or a friend, but I was alone. So I began to wonder what it feels like to be alone. And as you look at homeless people all around, you ask yourself, some of them are alone and some aren't. But I was alone through the whole 3 days, and other than having a camera around me, but...
Now, there's a little difference between your experience. Of course, you've got a taste of what that life is like by doing it for 3 days. But, of course, you knew that you could stop this at any time. There's a difference between people who are homeless. They have a little bit more difficult time turning their life around and coming out of it. What might you say about that?
Of course there is. There's a lot of issues pertaining to homelessness that people don't know. I mean, people say, well, why don't they just clean their act up and go get a job or go get an education, or he doesn't look like he can still walk and talk, and they're begging and so forth. And then it's not just that. It's more in depth. It's mental problems, health issues, low self-esteem, no education, no place to live, no address. You can't go on welfare if they were. And a lot of them get stuck in a place where, I guess you hear it all the time, rock bottom. You use terms of, you're in the very end and there, do you feel there's any help? I don't know. But there's so many things to a homeless person that if you sit with them and talk to them and get to kind of know them and let them tell you, not just by judging, just by the look of what he or she's wearing. And I think it's more deeper than anyone can ever imagine what it would be.
So what did you learn from talking to some of the homeless people?
That they're real. They're real people.
What does that mean?
What it means to me personally, I don't know about to anyone else, but they're real people with serious issues that they have to face day in and day out that I think we take for granted as, when we lay down or we have a good place to have, or a house or what have you, we have a job. and you look over at them, and most of them are happy, though. I mean, not happy with what they have, but they're happy genuinely, I guess. I'd say in most cases, happier than most of us. Not saying that that's, you know, is it bullshit? No, it isn't. I don't think it is. I think I've talked to a lot of them, and a lot of them laugh, and we talk, and we share, and they share things with me, not just about their hard everyday life, but, you know, we talk and we share intimate things and spiritual things, and I really like in listening with them, talking with them.
And of the people that you talked to, how many did you find had sort of resigned themselves to that as a lifestyle, and how many of them were maybe struggling to say, you know, this is a temporary situation, I want out of this?
Well, the ones I met, and there were some that didn't want to be interviewed or be a part of the documentary, some just declined right outright, and just for sake of, I guess, feeling, I don't know, embarrassed, maybe didn't want to see their face on camera and other people would have known them. The ones that did participate, there was more stuff that I could have added to the documentary. I chose not to. And people in the community were saying, well, once they viewed it and saw what they saw that I'd put together was, well, can we get it any more raw? I said, well, what's wrong with this? What's raw to you people? What do you want? You know, what do you guys want? Like, it was bad enough just to even get this person to sit with me and spend time with me and walking in the street and him or her showing me what he does every day. It's not easy. So it wasn't easy watching, learning. And what they shared with me, I guess, was a lot of intimate things about their personal self that I guess I don't want to talk about, because there's private things and there are personal things that I think people need to know, but they said to me, I wouldn't want you to show that, or I don't want you to talk about that. I said, okay, so you got to have that respect for them for that matter, right?
Yeah. And as I was asking, though, too, how many of them said, I don't want to resign myself to this. This is just a temporary thing. I'm wanting out. I'm working on getting myself out. How much of that was just talk for some people, even if they did say it? And how many people do you think it just was maybe a series of events and they just said, I'm not trying anymore. I'm just going to stay here in this kind of homeless situation?
That's a good question. When I asked two of the people, there was two people, one of the two is stuck in it. And he'd rather live out there. He has his reasons, his personal reasons he had shared with me. The other gentleman that was in the documentary got out because he had a job. He'd gotten a job, and that's what helped him get out. But he was in a relationship that went astray, and his partner left, and that caused him to go and seriously hit, I would say, rock bottom within himself, and he started to drink and end up living in a lot of bad places that were makeshift shelters that he stayed in. And I asked him, I said, well, what was it like when you were living out here? And he said, it was hard because I had a job, Harold, but I had no place. I just gotten this job. And I said, so did you go to work every day? He says, yeah, I went to work every day. But, you know, you're sick, you're hungover, and you're hungry, and you get up and you go to work every day. And then I said, so you come back to this. He goes, this is where I stay. So one got out, one didn't want to get out. Why? I don't know why the other guy was not choosing to want to get out, but he chose to be in the street and had family there. You begin to bond with other homeless people. That's what I also noticed. They become a family. If I'm not saying like first cousins or any of that. I'm talking about non-native, native, male, female, even if you weren't related, they became a bond. They bonded, and that's what they had. Other than immediate family, they were disconnected from that sort of life and learned to be with each other and trust and be safe, I guess.
Of the people that you talked to, did you find that as people were descending into a deeper and deeper state of homelessness and poverty, and they were bonding, as you mentioned, with other homeless people, that their thinking about the world changed, and their thinking about people who maybe were well off or had money or had a home? How did it change, and did it, well, I'll just leave it at that. How did it change?
For them?
Yeah.
The world around them? That's a good question, because we had NAG games in 2000 in August come into our community and Couch, and a lot of the homeless people that were staying along the rivers and the fields and the vacant areas, our people were cleaning up those areas, sort of like what's going on here with the 2010 games here. What's happening in Couchin was the community was cleaning up, and tribes was doing a lot of this and that and moving, and it started to invade where they were staying and literally just going in and ripping their tents down or their makeshift shelters and telling them to get the fuck out of here. And that was it. So, and they were talking to me about it, saying what's going on, and they knew about games, but why are we being, you know, forced away from this area? We've been here for like 8 months. Nobody's bothered us. Now I come back and I don't have a place, or my tent's been ripped down, and we're told to literally get out of here. And I'm like, okay, this is the reason why. He says, well, they're doing it in the wrong way. If they just could ask and tell us to move, we would move. You don't have to use force. So I saw a lot of that from him, and the frustration of their side, and by right, because it's sort of, that's their home, right? You know, when they come in there. So they were pissed about it. And, you know, I understand their side, but I also understand the other side. I mean, tribes was trying to make a point, you know, like, we have a clean area, and yeah, and we want these people to move. And that's what they did. So two sides of the people were pissed. One of the, you know, the organization that was spearheading the NAG were coming in and literally by force moving out the homeless people, native and non-native.
And what you said in the beginning of that was that the issue was about how it was done. I suspect that for some people, how it was done would not make a difference. So it was their home and they would probably not easily budge. But perhaps for some people, how it was done did make a difference, and I'm sure dignity is an important factor here, and especially since there's a stereotype of homelessness people, and people who aren't homeless will perhaps use the fact that they feel superior in their own minds financially as some kind of legitimacy to kick people who are down.
Yeah, I guess in a way, yeah. I can only look back at just, again, I'm going to go back to the games, because that's when I saw a lot of change in our community, because other than that, it was a big buzz. Before that came, there was no buzz. It was hype, it was talk, it was yeah, 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 yeah. Then the games came 2 months prior, and the whole areas that I knew of where I had stayed in my film were now clean. And then they started to go to the heart of it, where I call the heart of it is where a lot of the homeless people were staying. So they just went right to their area and leveled it and cleaned them right out. Was it a power trip? Was it, like the high and mighty of organizations coming in? Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are meek people, weak, and we can just go in there and say, well, you got to go, and this is what we're doing. We didn't ask, they forced them. And that's what we see all around. We see it here in Vancouver. We see it all over the place. So, and it doesn't sit well with people like me or the homeless people. And it doesn't need to be that way, because if you spend time with these people and maybe talk with them they understand. But if you show force to them and then they don't understand, there's a retaliation. And I don't know. I just don't get it. I guess what I would say, I don't know if this is right, but I would say that the governments use a lot of power. I won't say specifically what government, but I will say government organizations. If you're going to look at a homeless issue and say, okay, well, we're going to go down and we're going to, you know, people say flex their muscle, flex your power, and just literally move these people around by force, there's going to be serious consequences, and they will set up somewhere else, or there's other issues that they have to face. So I just look at the government like they're all political pimps, leaving us flat in our backs, trading today, waiting for the promised land. Roles playing roles, covered up by every day's fear, going off to work, having the job done on us. In the eyes of God, building the bomb. Loving thyself, hating thyself, in the illusion. That's what I have to say about that.
Oh, that's very poetic. If you had some final insights that you'd like to leave us with, what would that be? What was the greatest insight you had?
In regarding
making this film and the whole homeless and poverty issue?
it's an experience I'll never forget. It's something to me that we face as human beings. We'll face it. And with the recession in place now, there's going to be more. People say, is there a cure for homelessness? Well, I don't know. I don't think there is. It's almost like cancer. It comes and it'll keep coming. The government can and should and will step up. They have to. They can't just keep looking away from this issue. It's serious and it's going to get worse before it gets any better. So I just hope that people, you know, learn to begin to understand a little bit more. But I don't think we will unless you actually go down and hang out with these people. So for me personally, it'll be an experience I'll never forget, ever. And I enjoyed what I did, and I'd do it again.
You'd recommend it to others to try?
I would, yeah. Why not? Sure.
Thank you very much for talking with me today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Find out more about the film Broken Down at www.visionkeeper.ca. Allart is the producer/host of Dynamic Health, the radio program which airs live every Wednesday from 1 to 2 p.m. Pacific Time on CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. It can also be heard live online at www.dynamichealthradio.info. You'll find Allart's past shows there too, dynamichealthradio.info. We'll hear another interview from Allart next week as we tackle the question, are homeless women becoming the next invisible people? Look in those free dinner lineups or out on the street, you'll find plenty of men. But women lose their jobs and homes as well. Where are they? Next week on Radio EcoShock. By the way, we'll also have a special interview from Australia with one of that country's top scientists, Andrew Glickson. Dr. Glickson is one of the most outspoken climate experts. He warns the world is headed towards a catastrophe, with climate conditions not seen for millions of years. This new world system may not be suitable for mammals. Our breathing apparatus is not adapted for extreme heat worlds. Don't miss that, because no matter what happens to our economy, the big climate change has already arrived. The National Climatic Data Center for the United States has confirmed that March 2009 had the 10th highest combined global land and sea temperatures since records began in 1880. Hard measurements, my friends. Hard to deny. Let's get through some quick news that hit me between the eyes this week. Remember this one?
Along this corridor, plans are being formulated for the world's first eco-city to be built in China. A place where people can live and work and raise their children with minimal impact to the environment. Peter Head of the British design and construction company Arup is leading the design team for Dongtan City, which will eventually house 500,000 people.
This new British-designed eco-city was supposed to be built by now near Shanghai. The goal was completion of an energy-efficient city for 50,000 people by the opening of the Shanghai Expo in 2010. As cities use up to 80% of the world's resources and produce about that much waste as well, it was a great hope that China's new urbanization would begin with a sustainable model, something that would allow the Earth to survive hundreds of millions of new Asian urbanized consumers. According to an April 6th report published at the Yale website, almost nothing has been built. The article is titled, China's Grand Plans for Eco-Cities Now Lie Abandoned. The politicians pushing the ideas were booted out on a corruption scandal, and permits were not approved. Anyway, Dongtan, as the imagined city was called, was projected on a marshy area used by birds. Another Chinese green model project called Hengbaiyu in China's northeast has also failed. The green hay and pressed earth bricks were too expensive, and the design called for garages, though the villagers didn't have any cars. The tiny yards didn't allow for the animals necessary for subsistence. Basically, it sounds like a Western vision that didn't meet local Chinese needs. Meanwhile, General Motors is selling more cars in China than in the United States. In fact, China has become the largest market for new automobiles. From a green perspective, this transfer of the deadly car carbon culture to Asia sounds like a death knell for our atmosphere and for millions of Chinese people who will die of smog.
happy, happy, joy, joy, 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 joy. I don't think you're happy enough. That's right. I'll teach you to be happy.
Do you care about the world's forests? Remember Biosphere 2, the big dome where scientists tried to create a completely self-sustaining inner environment? That project failed because too many gases leaked in and out of the structure, but mostly because nature turned out to be too hard to duplicate. The dome is now used by the University of Arizona. Scientists led by Henry Adams planted pinyon pines inside and then ramped up the temperature by 7 degrees or 4 degrees Celsius to study the impact of global warming on trees. On current levels of carbon pollution, we can expect those kind of temperature rises. The study, published in the April 13th Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, found that temperature change led to a 28% faster die-off rate compared to today's climate. Even higher levels of carbon dioxide in the air did not help the trees, which shut down to prevent high water loss in the higher temperatures. The general message seems to be the world's forests may die off at a high rate as global warming proceeds. That was predicted by various computer models as forests turn to grasslands or even deserts. Other studies found that the great Amazon rainforest could dry out and burn. But now we have a real-world test of future conditions, and the verdict is very serious.
Now, boys and girls, let's try it again. Happy, happy, joy, joy, 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 joy. The little critters of nature, they don't know that they're ugly.
Climate deniers are always talking about the medieval warm period, when Greenland was greener and wine was made in England. That shows temperature gains are perfectly normal, they say. A new study by the Swiss Federal Institute in Bermansdorf analyzed tree rings in Morocco and a stalagmite in a cave below a Scottish peat bog and various other places in the world. And they discovered that the warm period was not global during medieval times, but localized to northern Europe. The cause appears to be a change in ocean currents, including the North Atlantic Oscillation. The scientists studied records from other parts of the world and found there was no truly global warming during that period, just a localized event, which knocks the socks off the argument made by the deniers, not that they'll listen. Look for that article in New Scientist, published April 2, 2009.
Now what do we do?
Well, we'll probably continue to mutate. Then our very molecules will more than likely begin to break up. I'm sure our atoms will disperse slowly throughout the universe. I guess it's hopeless.
My thanks to Ren and Stimpy for saving us all.
I don't know how you came by this record, but you are now embarked upon a journey that must certainly lead you to change your life forever. If you were never a special person, you are a special person now. Hello, Seeker.
Broadcast on 16 stations in Canada and the United States. Going out over the world by satellite and cable, podcast and downloads, you've got Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. At the beginning of this year, Radio EcoShock featured a speech by Professor Peter Newman. Well, he is now working to advise the Australian government of Kevin Rudd. Yet Newman says the government's plan to double its coal export capacity should be given up. Perversely, in a country so damaged by climate change, the government continued with costly plans to enlarge coal ports and build new heavy rail lines to the coal mines. To make a buck, they're willing to drown their northern half while the populated southern coast dies off from drought and fire brought on by climate change. Newman also says the government's $500 million promise for clean coal tech is a big waste of money. He is quoted in the Sydney Morning Herald for April 1st on supposed clean coal. He says, "I don't think that the science on that is anywhere near happening. In the U.S., it's already disappearing. It's going to disappear along with nuclear fission," end quote. Find Peter Newman's speech on resilient cities in the Radio EcoShock show for January 16th, 2009 at ecoshock.org. It's a free MP3 download. In fact, you'll find all our past programs there, plus tons of free audio on the environment, on peak oil, and the economic crisis. And thank you for caring about our world. Mother.